Blog Talk Radio.
Let me tell you about something new. A new show called G's Power.
G's Power.
Real talk for real saints.
Are you ready?
And it's for real.
Welcome to G's Power Hour, live every weekday at 11:30 a.m. on Never Had It So Good Entertainment Network. Your host, G, will bring you informative and entertaining guests and a variety of topics in a way that you can absorb and enjoy. Listen in weekdays and call in at 516-387-1944. We love interaction. All shows can be downloaded if you miss one or found on iTunes the next day. G's Power Hour is powered by Never Had It So Good Sports Media Network.
G's Power Hour.
Yeah.
Good morning, brothers and sisters, kings and queens, angels and saints, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to G's Power Hour on Never Had It So Good Entertainment. I am your host, G. Thanks so much for being with us today. So, as some of you should know, most of you should know already, that it is the celebration of Juneteenth today, and we are to have Professor Julian Chambliss on with us to kind of give us the rundown. We just can't let him go from Orlando. Professor, are you available? Are you there?
I'm here.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much. Glad to have you with us. So, I mean, like I said, we just can't let you go. You were here on Friday at Hannibal Square, right?
That's true, yeah. I gave a presentation for the Juneteenth celebration for the Hannibal Square Community Land Trust, you know, organization really dedicated to providing low and moderate income housing to the community in Hannibal Square. So, kind of fight against the gentrification displacement. But, it was a good talk, and people seem to enjoy it. Happy to visit back in my old haunts in Central Florida.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have you back here. I just have a question for you. How often or how regularly do you come across people that still don't know what Juneteenth is? I just came out of a meeting, and I still found people that had no clue in terms of what it was or what it is. So what is your encounter with that?
I think that's true, especially for a lot of younger people. They haven't heard that particular holiday, very particular, you know, very unique in terms of African American experience, Juneteenth. And so it's not common for a lot of people. There is, a small and dedicated cadre of people, often through familial relations, that have very strong connections to Juneteenth, depending on where you're from. And I think the pattern of migration and the movement of African Americans out of the South does really inflect how strongly a particular region might have a Juneteenth celebration or recognition of Juneteenth. Because it's not something that's necessarily ingrained in a lot of public structures, right? So it really becomes a question of how the community and institutions within the community and within the Black community celebrate it.
Right. Because I'm sure, for example, in Texas, where it kind of originated out of, in terms of it being the last state to recognize the Emancipation Proclamation, it's probably a huge deal there, whereas other places, it just really – it lacks some sort of significance until you really are educated in terms of what it's about.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of I think it's very strong in Texas, but it's also strong across the South and into the West as people move out of Texas over time,
mm-hmm.
right? And it's also a holiday I think had a lot more emphasis early in the 20th century, as a lot of Black holidays. Like, no one really celebrates Emancipation Day, which is a different day, right? Like, it's a different kind of celebration often. Juneteenth is June 19th, but Emancipation Day, of course, I can't remember right now, but it's technically a different day.
Right.
It's part of, like, a kind of Black sort of celebratory infrastructure that was created by African Americans in the 19th century, and sort of persists into the early 20th century, but then gets sort of displaced, I think, by the very real transformation associated with the sort of like high watermarks of the civil rights movement, right? Like there's just the need for these holidays doesn't seem as pressing for African Americans as we get into these other sort of like benchmark days that are sort of transformative and the institutionalized, right? Like the Brown Boys and Board of Education, civil rights benchmarks that we associate with the civil rights activism of the 50s and 60s. These get a lot more attention because they're institutionalized by the government. You know, even though, like, you think about the struggle to get a Martin Luther King holiday, there are lots of earlier black figures that arguably should get a holiday, right? Like, it's only been recently, to my mind, that, like, Frederick Douglass Day has been celebrated. And you see a lot of activism around that. But, you know, we don't get a Sojourner Truth Day or Harriet Tubman Day, and like, as far as I know, like, those aren't major celebratory days. And that's
right.
A lot of that about politics and infrastructure around commemoration.
Right. So true. But one thing I have noticed, though, I think I've seen more celebrations this year than I've seen in a long time. Have you noticed that? And what do you attribute that to?
You know, I do think that one of the things that is happening is that we have a new generation of African Americans who are returning to the South, sort of connecting with their roots and connecting with family stories of the black experience, and also have the resources for celebration at some very basic level. And these people are the people, I think, who are driving engagement with the black cultural celebratory activities. That it has been an uptick in the last decade without question. I think this is part of the reason why I think these same class of people are the same people who are like really intrigued by what would it be to actually have reparations, right? I mean, you know, I don't think there's a coincidence that we're having congressional discussions about reparations,
right,
for African Americans, and you have that at the same time, these sort of commemoration things, because of course, if you remember what happened to African Americans, then some of the consequences of that remembering is like, well, you know, this sort of systematic oppression of African Americans should be addressed in a systematic way, right? What
right.
about equity, right? And so I think we can trace this back to a number of things, not as if reparation is something that hasn't happened before, but this is cyclical. I remember in the early 90s, there was a real sort of discussion about reparations. Now we're spinning out of that kind of generational shift as African Americans sort of challenged sort of standard narratives around race and space and sort of put an emphasis on sort of like hip-hop culture and black culture. And that was a particular moment. You know, we had these debates around black vernacular language, like, you know, Ebonic debate, for instance, if you remember those struggles in the early 90s. And
right.
so the cycle has come back around, and you see, I think, a really deep engagement driving multiple kinds of inquiry about black experience, black culture, systemic oppression, and I think also the current political climate where, you know, arguably the Trump sort of weaponizes white aggrievement. And this is forcing everyone who's not white to be like, wait a minute, what are you aggrieved about? This is what actually happened to us, what happened to you, right? And so, like, you know, he talks about being victimized and, like, you know, takes on this sort of, like, persona of white victimization. But the reality is that, like, the system does not victimize white people. The system is set up in a way where if you're non-white, your experiences are demonstrably different, right? Like you can point to systemic ways that you have been abused over time, and that abuse has a cumulative effect, right? Like the lack
right.
of black wealth is not just simply some sort of accident. It's a systemic consequence of action. And so we're in a place where, like, you know, this dialogue around oppression in the United States has gone through a kind of funhouse mirror. And if you actually start to remember what actually happened, a lot of that lot, you know, that rhetoric is challenged by history, by the truth, by remembering, right? And so I think that's part of the landscape as well.
I want to talk a little bit about what, other than just celebrations, how do we tell the story and make a more significant impact? And one of the places where I think that has to happen is in the schools and in the history books and in the literature and in the libraries. I think there needs to be a concerted effort to make sure that the story is told from childhood and not just, what's this celebration about? Oh, we're having a celebration because this was the day. And someone needs to explain the process about why it took 2.5 years or whatever from the time of the Emancipation Proclamation for, you know, and what, you know, what the ramifications of this change meant, and also, you know, how did it affect people who were, for example, one day you're a slave and the next day all of a sudden you're a free person.
Right. You know, I think we do have a real struggle in terms of African-American history, history of people of color in general in the United States. Not the sense that, like, the information is not available, but in terms of the schools, there are a number of sort of structural limitations here, right? Because you talk about this often, the testing regime in schools. History is not really required, you know, in the way that it used to be. Like, you not require a course person in Florida schools, in the college, you know, you're not required to take history. It's a choice, right? So, you know, American history education at the collegiate level and then American history education at the K-12 level can be spotty. You can get it, like, you know, depending on the teacher, depending on the school, but there's also quite possible you won't get it. And so that puts a lot of pressure on public institutions like your history museum, like a Smithsonian. I mean, I think part of the phenomenon of the African American History Museum is that now that's the first time someone's actually put like this sort of huge collection all in one place with the intention of telling this story. And that's also the appeal of the PBS infrastructure created by Henry Louis Gates, right? Those specials that he has where he tells the history of African Americans, tells the history of Africa. I mean, the popularity of those things indicate, you know, people haven't had the opportunity, and now they have the opportunity. They're like, flood, you know, they run to see it. So, you know, when we point to the successes of things like that, you think about how this is like a pent-up demand. And the way that people can address that is, like, you know, you can get more involved at the local level with your cultural institutions that are dedicated to history and dedicated to culture. Like, we forget how important it is to sort of be engaged with those institutions, volunteer with them, you know, be in conversation with them as they think about programming, as they think about developing programming. You know, it's a choice that they make, and their sense of the audience is based on, like, feedback that they get. So if you go to this and go, oh, I'd like to see more African American history, if you volunteer at these organizations and become a part of the organization, you're like, well, you know, we can talk about African American history in the context of talking about World War II, or we can talk about African American history in the context of talking about independence. you know, that brings Black people's story into the context. And there's lots of quality scholarship that's available to support that, right? You know, there's often like this narrative like, oh, we don't, academics don't talk to people. Well, that's not really true. You know, there's a lot of activism on the part of academics, Black and white men and women, to tell stories that are more inclusive and more equitable. And you can find that information and you can use it in the context of your local community to make a better story. And many of those organizations would be happy to have that support because they live and die on volunteers. They live and die on donations. So if you have a church and you're like, we don't have enough African-American history, well, you know, you should start have a conversation in your church about, you know, there's a local history museum. We should be engaged with it as an institution, as a congregation, both in terms of our bodies and our money, because a little bit of money in a small organization has a very tight budget is the difference between something they won't do and something they will do. So my standard advocacy for people is if you see a need, start local and go about that process and engage in, you know, if you want to volunteer in your local school, that could be a way for you to be there and advocate for more African-American history. I do believe that that's a process that history tells us parents did in the past, and we're in a place where our institutions are not as responsive to the will of the people, Black or white, who might want to see, you know, a more equitable narrative for a variety of reasons. I often want to caution people to think about if your teacher, your evaluation is around how well people do on the test. So there's a real narrow window for your ability to tell a story that's not going to be assessed. So when you hear about the state legislature talking about, well, we're revisiting educational benchmark, you need to pay attention because that's the opportunity for you to, like, you're not doing a good job around this, this, and that. You need to call your representative. You need to call them, too. Don't write a letter. Call their office. That's the other thing. Like, don't write a letter. Call their office. Like, they catalog people calling. Letters can get lost. And make that kind of engagement. So there's a sort of like grassroots, the things that are close by where you can have an impact, and I think that's really important work, especially in today, and that can make a difference. But it takes time, and it does take some clarity in terms of, like, you know, your dedication to those questions.
Speaking of taking some time and dedication, I want to talk, I guess I would say, on a related subject, and since we're talking Black history, about the recent events surrounding the Groveland 4 this week, and this year, starting with Governor DeSantis pardoning the Groveland 4. And then other things that have come up since then, there have been other discussions, including the fact that whether or not they should have actually really been pardoned versus, you know, exonerated, because there's debate, of course, in terms of whether or not they actually really did anything. Well, there's
right.
debate among people. So is this one of those things like you were talking about, where taking the time and doing the research and making sure that it's being pushed and presented in the forefront? I know last year, before Governor DeSantis did this, there was a PBS presentation, and it was over. They had a preview of it in the Winter Garden Theater about the Groveland 4, and then there was another movie, I think, that came out this year. So can you talk a little bit about the steps in terms of
of the time? And also, too, where do you get the information? Because I'm sure that's not something that you just go to your public library and find.
Well, you know, I think there's two things that are going on there. On one hand, the decision to pardon is, yeah, that's growing out of probably 10 years of activism on the part of community members and historians and local archivists and activists.
Mm-hmm.
Pardoning is a political act, right? Like, what can the governor do?
Right.
And what's the benefit for the governor? Well, the governor can pardon. And in pardoning, that's a kind of like state acknowledgement of some wrongdoing. At least that's how it's cast, right? Like, you know, presidents can pardon people, governors can pardon people. A pardon's not the same thing as like admitting, like, oh yeah, they were wrongly accused. You're right. But
exactly.
From a political standpoint, that's what a governor can do, and they get the political points for doing it. Now, in the context of Groveland, it's pretty obvious for a lot of people. It's obvious, probably not for everybody, that they were innocent, right?
Right.
We can talk endlessly about that. So, you know, there's a politics of that, and that's the reality. When we started talking about where can you find information, you know, there are a number of scholars who write about race and civil rights, and yeah, you can go to the library and find that, right? I mean, if you're looking for some sort of accessible work on Black history, and you can always go to the Journal of Negro History, which is like a classic, or the Negro, or like, you know, African American History Journal. Like, these are like classic things started by Carter G. Woodson. But, you know, the Smithsonian has a lot of infrastructure now because of the African American History Society. PBS has a lot of information because of like their many years sort of dedication to African American history with their specials. And almost every one of those specials has a companion website that has research and documentation and things like that. Many state archives and across the United States have archives that are very dedicated, and they created material around the Black history, women's history, so on and so forth. I would be hard pressed to find a state that doesn't have something related to that. The question is, if it's a controversial issue, some of that is sometimes not known. And you can think about the work of something like an Equal Justice Institute out of Birmingham, outside of Montgomery, where like they've gone through and like they're doing work to document things that were not documented, right? And some of those incidents for years were undocumented and only been documented recently. So there's a difference between work that is sort of building on kind of established historical recovery that's been done for many years, and these smaller incidents that we don't know about and might be family lore and are just going to come to the fore as you have more and more work being done by organizations like the Equal Justice Institute. So my first answer is like, yeah, you know, you can find really good work in the library. You can find really good work online. I mean, what you're looking for is institutions that you can trust and that have good information. So, you know, African American Intellectual History Society has a blog called Black Perspective, and they publish really short pieces by scholars, often telling you sort of hidden Black history stories. But, you know, all this other material is out there. And, again, you just have to sort of take the time. If there's an incident that you know about but no one knows, then that really becomes a question of how can you connect to some organization that's going to help you out with that. I think, again, you can start local if you know of some sort of incident, and especially if you have documentation. Start sort of talking to your local institution and see and sort of check if you have a a community college or a college near you, if there's a professor there who's teaching about things like this, maybe they'll be willing to talk to you and help you, sort of like direct you to a place where like your papers could be stored. Like another thing about this is African American documents were not collected in the same way that white documentation is collected, right? So the victor go to spoils. And so the story of how African Americans are displaced, the story of how African American property is destroyed, or the stories of terror against African Americans, we have those stories in piecemeal ways sometimes, and they have to be reconstructed. And the black voice is often absent. So it's important for families who have, like, you know, the family Bible, who have, you know, archival evidence, pictures of the past, even pictures that you don't think are meaningful or super meaningful for a researcher. Like if you have a picture of your great-grandfather standing in front of a house or standing, you know, so out someplace, yes, that's a picture of your great-grandfather, but there might be a lot of stuff in the background that would be super useful for a researcher. So, you know, everybody's family history is a part of a bigger national history, and thinking about ways that you can sort of preserve that and add that to the national record. It's something that, you know, every family can do. And if there's a question mark here around an incident or violence or something that was taken or destroyed, you know, if your family member survived one of these racial incidents that we have documented, or if they know about some incident that happened after a big incident. Often when you have, like, violence against African Americans, the actual big incident might be documented, but there are a lot of small incidents that happen after, maybe 6 months, a year, 2 years after, that are the same people. There are sort of like, you know, aftershocks from that original incident, and we don't often know about those, right? Like, I'm doing a project about a man named Oscar Mack, and he was attacked after, the year after Okoye. And in the documentation, you can see that, like, the same people who did the Okoye thing, the fear is, like, these same people are the same people after Oscar Mack. And that's a year later, right? The Okoye thing we kind of know about now, but it's a year later. So, you know, the onus is sometimes our families think about how they're a part of a bigger whole and look for ways to make that story available to people.
I know you have to go in a couple minutes, but I wanted to ask you, like I said, you were just in Orlando. I have you on today. I know you've been doing other stuff around this time. But are we losing our storytellers? I mean, you see, a lot has been put upon you recently, you know, and I've had you on a couple of other times. Are we losing people that are willing to do the research and preserve the history and tell the story?
Well, you know, I don't think of it that way. I mean, I think you mean in terms of, like, are we getting people to be teachers and professors and archivists and things like that? And that is a legitimate question. It is a somewhat complicated path to go into academia. And we probably do want to encourage a new generation. Like, I would say, like, ironically, you know, I'm not a young man anymore. And, like, all the older professors just laugh at me, but I'm like, I'm not. Like I've been out school 20 years now. Right? So, you know, like, when you look at, are there other people in graduate school studying the same thing? There are, but the number of jobs for professors is going down. Like, we're cutting money for education at the collegiate level. Like, you know, state support for universities is going down. So a lot of work is falling to sort of adjunct people. So without these sort of like tenure track jobs, and a lot of this work can be controversial. So if you're not tenured, you know, it's, you have to be really careful about how you do this work, because, you know, work of uncovering what's happening to people of color, uncovering what's happened to violence against LGBTQ people, or it doesn't matter, like whatever sort of like marginalized group that might be persecuted, if you're like documenting that work and telling that story, it can create like tension. So that is a question. And again, that goes back to the politics around this. A lot of institutions of higher education are public institutions. They get a lot of money from the state. And in Florida, but not just in Florida, across the country, over the last 20, 25 years, the amount of support has just dropped, right? Because we're just cutting back on education. We're cutting back on it at the collegiate level. We're cutting back on it also at the K-12 level. And so that becomes like a political question. And if you can't make money doing it, like if you're not paid, a lot of African Americans aren't going to, you know, if they're, you know, striving for it and they made it into college and, you know, it's a big deal, they want to make sure they're going to be able to sustain themselves. I think it's often a passion project for a lot of African Americans to be telling these kind of stories. That becomes again, a kind of institutional question. One of the things that people can do if they want to see this kind of work continue is that they can endow. They can endow chairs of African American history. Every higher education institution in the United States, if you call their foundation relation people, and they will tell you this is how much it costs to endow a chair. And it's to endow a chair, I think, at a place like the University of Florida, which is a research university, I think that's like $1 million or something like that. It may be less than that, but, you know, you have to think about like at least $500,000. And so, you know, is that worth it to you? Right? Like, is it worth it to you to like have a story of African Americans told in an institutional way? Because like when you endow something, you get to decide how the money is going to be spent. So you can just say straight out, I want this person to study African American history and produce research around African Americans. And if you want that person to always give a public talk, you can have that in the endowment papers. Like whoever has this chair will give a public talk every year on Juneteenth. And they'll do that. Like that's part of the endowment. You know, it's a politics of education, or it's also economic, right? Like, the state doesn't support, that means private people move in to support. We can talk about this endlessly in the context of how conservatives have funded, like, an alternative set of educational media publications to tell their version of history. African Americans can pool their money and do the similar sort of things. And, you know, that is a legitimate response to this, right? Like, I can endow a chair. You don't have to have $1 million, but if you get, you know, 1,000 of your friends, and some of these big churches got 1,000 members, right? Like, you know, it's a 3-year project. This is our goal. They always take the money. And you can sit down with them and like, these are the things I need to see, and dial a chair, and then they'll go out and hire somebody, and they will do those things. Right. So just think about it, right? Like, I urge people to always think about it. Like, well, you know, like that's part of the way things happen.
Right.
And, you know, we often laud like really rich African Americans. They'll do like these sort of big things, like, you know, recently Robert Johnson paid for the graduating class, and Oprah's giving money to.
Right.
But then, you know, maybe one less million, and be like, well, I'll dial a couple of chairs here, you know, and a bill, you know. That's real.
Right.
And, you know, you name an African American who's well known in your community. You make a campaign like, okay, we're going to work on this for 5 years. We're going to raise the money for this endowment. You can have this public presentation element in it. And they will hire somebody because, like, they want that money. Because when you endow something, what happens is that that endowment pays for that faculty member. So basically, you're freeing up money from an institution standpoint. That's why they'll always take it. Like, oh, we can use this money because this endowment is going to pay for this person's salary and such and such. And so we can use this money for something else, right? So it's like a benefit to them. And it could be a benefit for you, too. So I understand your question. That's a real concern, but, it's wrapped up in these broader structural issues related to education and state funding. But, yeah, can you do something? I would say yes. You know, I often sound like a broken record. I'm like, well, you know, the history of African Americans, like they get together and they do collective things in the face of, like, opposition that you and I, you know, as a person who's only lived through, like, sort of, like, post-civil rights, they're like, no matter how bad things are, they were never as bad as for my grandmother, right? Like, they were never that bad, right? So, like, I'm always, like, mindful, like, oh, I could probably do a little bit more. These people did a lot more with a much more unstable landscape around them. So before I can play, I'll see if I can, like, pitch in a little. And I think that's true for everybody. So that's what I would say.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked the question though, because you brought some interesting things to light. Because when we do have all these organizations, we have fraternities and sororities, and we have trade organizations that could probably come together and do some of these things that will make a bigger and longer lasting impact in terms of telling the stories and prolonging the knowledge of the history of African Americans in our society. So I appreciate you taking the time out today. Thank you. And you took a little extra, and I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. I better get going. Well, good luck. And I hope you have a good rest of the show.
Thank you. Happy Juneteenth to you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Have a blessed day.
Bye-bye.
That was Professor Julian Chambliss, and we always appreciate having him on. This is G's Power Hour. I've never had a so good entertainment. I am thinking about just taking a break and enjoying Juneteenth, so we are probably going to end the show. I want to remind you to join us tomorrow because we have tomorrow, Friday, because we have a couple of our regulars on. We have Burton Kelso on tomorrow. It's Tech Thursday, and then Friday is Friday in the Garden. So please feel free to join us. If you have any interesting topics that you want us to cover on G's Power Hour, you know I'll do my best to do it. Send me a message on the G's Power Hour Facebook page. And also, we enjoy any type of comments that you might have, any questions that you might have, and also we could use some advertisers. So anyway, have a very blessed day, everyone. We'll talk tomorrow. This is G's Power Hour. Never had a so good entertainment. And please remember, all real power comes from God. Take care.
through the way.